House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, April 6, 2009. Towards the end of the agenda, House Bill 2339 is being carried over until Wednesday.
Which one?
And 2339. And we're going to be going out of order for open a public hearing on House Bill 3191. Representative, okay, go ahead.
House Bill 3191 establishes a retired senior volunteer program within the Department of State Police. It allows a retired state trooper to volunteer and receive health care insurance for themselves and their spouse. We do not yet have a fiscal impact statement on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kim Thatcher, state representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And actually, Mr. Chair and I bring this bill to you, 3191, today at the request of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. And it's an idea that has been worked on for a number of years, and it was introduced last session. But perhaps now more than ever, this concept helps us for some obvious reasons, and that would be money, or rather the lack of it. We have all seen the numbers recently. Budget's not looking too good, looking at 30% cuts. On the list for cuts in the state police, they're talking about wiping out huge chunks of programs inside the agency, including sex offender work and the evidence technicians. Many of you remember a few years ago, maybe just a couple years ago, how we were able to put 10 troopers back on the road by hiring non-sworn personnel to fill the roles of the evidence technicians. I think we all agree that troopers should be out in the field and not riding a desk, like was often referred to back in last session. Bringing in retired officers in a volunteer capacity to do office work would go a long way to help us survive this budget crisis. Bringing in volunteers is a trend that's happening all over the country. One example is in Tucson, Arizona, where they're using 55 retired cops to help with the workload while they try to fill a backlog of vacancies. At the Portland Police Department, they have a half dozen volunteers working in their cold case unit, ranging in age from 58 to 77 years old. There's even a former commander and a retired judge. In both cities, we hear the same comments. There's no substitute for experience. Not only do these volunteers feel that they're making a contribution and helping out, but the agency folks love having them around because of their rich background. In fact, many of the paid detectives in the Portland unit have less than 4 years in that assignment compared to the 20 to 30 years on the force that the older guys have. It's a great mentoring opportunity. Just ask the good representative from Gold Beach. You can learn a lot from an not old cop, a non-chronologically
experience.
Challenged cop. There we go.
Experienced.
Someone asked me once.
You want this bill to pass?
How come we don't have volunteer police like we have volunteer firefighters? Well, each profession obviously operates differently, but it was a fair question, so we did a little checking, and you do see volunteers in our police force all the time. For example, younger crowds, you see the cadets or explorer scouts, usually helping with search and rescue or parking patrol at events and other duties. The older volunteers, they're sometimes called auxiliary or reserve officers, sometimes paid part-time, sometimes not. And there's already precedence for this type of program with our retired judges in Oregon. They get health benefits in exchange for volunteering on the bench for a certain number of days in a month. And the bill seeks to fill a need for both sides. The police agency gets manpower or woman power, as it may be, to take care of certain duties, and the volunteers would get health benefits, which can be a real problem for retirees before they're actually eligible for Medicare. And you'll notice that the bill does not require OSP, Oregon State Police, to implement the program unless they feel like they have the necessary funding. But I would submit that paying for health benefits for a few good volunteers would go a long way towards stretching the few dollars the agency has on hand for critical operations. And just to be clear, we're not talking about using all this free labor to take the place of a real paid trooper working out in the field to bust bad guys. Otherwise, I doubt I would have the head of the Oregon State Police Officers Association sitting here in support. So two final things. The agency did not come to talk to me about the bill, and I did find out, I did find out that they may have some concerns about wage and hour or other employment issues. So we checked with legislative counsel, and they are actually here today behind me to provide backup, as well as you were. This legislation does not violate any state or federal employment laws. Number two, there is a dash one amendment before you. It makes a really simple change. It just adds the word Oregon in front of the retired senior volunteer programs, because somebody at the federal level was using that same name and was concerned that we were violating some sort of federal copyright. I don't know. So we're just changing it to the Oregon RSVP program. There are several retired troopers in my legislative district who write me on a regular basis, and a couple of them tried to be here today but couldn't fit this into their schedule. I guess you get a little more busy as you get retired, as you become retired, I hear. Instead, here's a brief comment from John Rizzo of my district, who lives in Kaiser. He served on the state police force for a number of decades, and he's convinced. He says this could save the state police a fair amount of money for training and support services. If we give retired troopers a way to donate some of that experience to the junior officers, I know it could go a long ways to help OSP survive the budget turmoil that we're facing. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I passed around some written testimony from a gentleman by the name of Thomas Benz. Tom is a retired sergeant from the Oregon State Police and one of the finest troopers I ever had the privilege to work with. I worked for him for a period of about 5 years in a marine smuggling unit, and I learned more from that man in 5 years than I think I have from any other person on this department. In all due respect to Representative Krieger or Representative Olson, one of the finest troopers I've ever had the opportunity to work with. My name is Jeff Leedy. I'm one of your Oregon State Police senior troopers and the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 3191. I've been a state trooper for over 23 years. In that time, I've worked in both the patrol and criminal divisions. I've had the privilege of working with some of the finest police officers in the state, if not the nation. I've also watched their vast amount of experience walk out the door after these officers have retired. Many OSP officers throughout the state have no clerical or support staff at all, forcing troopers and sergeants to perform all of these tasks themselves. In these locations, they cannot impound the vehicles of suspended or revoked or DUII drivers, as there's no one to release the vehicles during working hours. There are no evidence technicians. There's no one registering sex offenders. I'm going to repeat that. There is no one registering sex offenders at these offices. This would assist greatly in getting more of these people registered. We have no cold case unit. All of these tasks and a myriad of others could easily and efficiently be performed by OSP retiree volunteers. It also has the added benefit of mentoring of the younger troopers. Volunteering for medical insurance coverage makes perfect sense. The Department of State Police and the State of Oregon would benefit greatly from this program. It would also help those who devoted a career in protecting all of us. Your state police are facing tough challenges ahead. This bill will go a long way towards helping with the increased workloads and stress that awaits us. God willing, Oregon State troopers will retire, making way for new troopers, but there is no reason to squander their skills and experience. I'd also like to add the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance is also in support of this bill. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
This is Representative Krieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just got stopped for speeding coming back from Coquille this morning, so people are working out there.
I won't ask the obvious question.
Sir.
Were you drunk?
You mentioned Tom Benz as being a fine officer. He recruited in Gold Beach, and guess who his coach was? Tom and I worked a long time, both in, when he went from game to criminal, but he is one of the people that you could call back in on cold case, and that guy will pick stuff up that was missed and to waste what he's got in his head and his experience. And even more important to that, is those contacts of personal working relationships of trust with the other agencies, district attorneys, people that talk to one another down at the port, down at the bar. Those type of officers, you just don't replace them with a recruit. You just can't do it. It's no different than some of the legislators here that have spent some time, and they excel over time because of the skills they have. But I think it'd be a great program.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, I'm going to have a hard time supporting any bill that puts Representative Olson back on our highways. Representative Krieger, I have no trouble with. But actually, my question, and I'm wondering, the analogy, for example, between retired judges and retired cops, state troopers, I'm thinking, are there annual requirements that our state troopers, we require them to do, for example, in training, et cetera, that I'm wondering that we might actually have, if we are having state troopers on the road, retired or otherwise, who are no longer receiving up-to-date training, I'm concerned about potential liability.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Barton, these people would not be out working the road. I envision these people doing our evidence tech jobs in our offices. I envision them registering sex offenders, being there in the office. If we're going to open up an office 24/7, it'd sure be nice to have someone in that office and turn the lights on or off. They could shuttle vehicles. They could mentor young troops. They could do some training. They're not going to be out to alleviate your fears of Representative Olson being on the road.
Terrorizing me on the highway.
No problem with that whatsoever. But that's not how I envision this.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. And if to the extent that's the intent of the bill, and that sounds great, I really appreciate you bringing this forward. I don't actually see that in the statute itself. Now, presumably that would be accommodated by rule or whatever, but if that is indeed the intent, I think it would probably be best that the statute itself reflect that. Unless it does, then I dismissed it.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, to do otherwise would violate the collective bargaining agreement that we have. So,
right.
Thank you. I have one question. I don't know if you would know the answer on the volunteer waives liability, but can they do that? I mean, if somebody gets hurt at work, if a file cabinet tips over on them or something, wouldn't it be better to have them covered under safe? I mean, one accident that somebody sues the state over would probably cost a lot more than the premiums, which would make it would prevent the state from being hit really hard if something happened to somebody. It's on 7A on page 2.
Chair Barker, committee, I don't really have an answer for that. I know that we've had volunteers in the past. We've run volunteer handicap parking enforcement in the past, and we currently have in some of the larger offices practicum students from colleges doing some of this administrative work.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John Schultz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services. And I came here today to raise the issue, Mr. Chair, that you just raised. And I think this bill does proposes a very laudable action. However, I wanted to raise a couple of concerns. Volunteers do get hurt, and they do file workers' compensation claims. And benefits are due to injured volunteers.
As injured workers.
If, as this bill does, the legislature determines that certain workers are not subject workers or not subject to the law for workers' compensation, then those workers, if they're hurt on the job, do not have the avenue of workers' compensation to file a claim. What that means for the worker is loss of certain benefits. What that means for the employer, in this case the state of Oregon, is loss of protection of the exclusive remedy doctrine. That means that the volunteer does have the right to take the employer to circuit court for their injuries. This, as was already mentioned, I believe, the state police do have endorsements on their workers' compensation policy for their Explorer Scouts and for their reserve officers. That means those individuals, those volunteers or workers, are covered by their workers' compensation policy. I'm here today to raise the issue of workers' compensation, make sure you are aware of it, and offer myself to work with the proponents, the State Police Association, anybody who wants to delve into this to assist in providing information as well as what it might take to provide protection for those workers. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Yes.
Can you get us any figures on the existing endorsements, who they cover, and what it's costing per person or per hour, so we have that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I can request that information. The Safe Corporation is the carrier. I know that, but I don't have the exact figures, and I will request those and get back to the committee with the answer.
Thank you.
Did I understand it correctly, like the disabled parking patrol, those people would have been covered? Do you have a, would have been covered under SAFE or not?
Mr. Chair, if they are part of the state police policy under an endorsement, for example, they mentioned the Explorer Scouts or reserve officers are covered. If they fall into those categories of employees, yes, they would be covered under the existing policy.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And Alan Dale.
Hi. Hello. Do I just start talking?
Yeah, go ahead.
By yourself for the record. My name's Alan Dale. I am Deputy Legislative Counsel. I have... Sorry, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I've been asked simply to comment on the question about in subsection 7A that the department may require the volunteer to waive any legal cause of action against the department for injury or disease arising out of the course of providing the volunteer services. Just the legal question is that the using the word may makes it permissive, so this still gives the department the ability to sort of run numbers, basically, and figure out which is the better path to go.
So they don't need to, if they didn't cover them, then the person, even though they waived it, would still have a right of action, cause of action?
I'm sorry? Could you repeat?
So if a volunteer says, okay, I'll sign that I waive liability, but they're not covered by SAFE, would they not have a cause of action if they got injured? Or could they still sue the state?
They could. Well, if you're... they would not have a cause of action under this as drafted. The gentleman's previous testimony... Sorry, Mr. Schultz's testimony is another question that hasn't been put before us, so I can't actually give you a dispositive answer about his testimony.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up. And Mary Botkin, please.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I actually thought this was a great bill till I heard the testimony. All those clerical positions that they're going to do, those are our jobs. So if you're going to add in to the bill that they're going to be doing clerical jobs, we need to also add in a phrase that they will not displace any current employee. You know, I mean, nobody wants to testify against volunteers, but you can't run the state with volunteers. And if we're going to register sex offenders, those people actually work under our contract. And I don't know if we have contract language protecting them, but my sense is we probably do. And so we just need to check and be sure that we're not running afoul of our contract language in our zeal to put volunteers into field offices where there are currently no people currently working. And I mean, I agree with the theory of the bill, but it's the practical implementation of the bill that may create some problems. And I don't want the committee to think that there could not be some problems associated with it. And I just don't know.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mary. On the first page on line 2930, the department may not use the services of a volunteer to replace or displace paid personnel. It says that right there.
I understand that, but the testimony was somewhat different than that. I mean, the testimony said that they wouldn't replace troopers. We're not considered troopers. We were non-uniform staff, and so I don't think that Mr. Leedy was trying to replace us, but I just want to make sure that there's no sort of unintended consequences as we work the bill. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, it's not ready to go. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3139. I'm sorry, 3191, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3092. Representative Hoffman. Oh, I'm sorry. So I want 31. Okay, I'm sorry. 30. We're going to open the House Bill, close the temporary to close the 3092 and open 3157. Confusing schedule.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Huffman, State Representative for District 59, and I'm so glad you changed that to 3157 because I didn't know what to say otherwise. I was at a loss for words, which I pretty much am anyway, and that's why I have Wasco County Youth Services Director Molly Rogers with me to explain what this bill fix is for North Oregon Correctional Facility, NORCOR, the regional jail based out of the Dalles. And so I'm going to turn it over to Molly and let her explain what we're doing here.
Great. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. It's good to see you. My name is Molly Rogers. I'm the director of the Wasco County Department of Youth Services. And I really appreciate your time and hearing how the bill in some ways clarifies the role of the juvenile directors in relationship to the Northern Oregon Correctional Facility. Back in 1999, four counties came together and joined in a Chapter 190 intergovernmental entity and passed bonds in order to build the facility. At that time, most of the focus was on the adult facility. Actually, almost all of the focus was on the adult facility, and a bill was entered and passed clarifying the role of the sheriffs in the four counties and how they work together in an oversight committee with the board of directors of NORCOR, who are county commissioners. At that time, I do not believe that the need was seen for the same relationship with the juvenile directors. However, over the past 10 years, we have seen that the juvenile directors need the same status as the sheriffs in order for our counties to work together the way we have done that. So the bill really puts forth that language. Just to clarify, in the state of Oregon, this is the only detention facility formed, developed, and paid for through an intergovernmental entity. So it does not affect any of the other juvenile detention facilities in the state of Oregon. The way the statute currently reads is really, it could technically reflect back that the detention facility is located in Wasco County, and so that as a juvenile director in that county, the responsibilities somewhat lie on my shoulders as the director. And while sometimes that means it's a little easier, it seems pretty arrogant of me to be able to be in that position where there's three other counties who have the same level of ownership. Before you, I have some written testimony that shares some additional information and references to the ORS. The other piece of written testimony that I provided for you today is from Gillam County, from the juvenile director there. She was not able to come today because it's court day. And for those of you who know where Gillam County is, court day does not happen very often. The other piece that I'd like to share is Hood River County Juvenile Director Donita Husky-Wilson sent an email wanting me to advise that Hood River County commissioners are fully informed and in support of the bill as well. And Amber DeGrange, the fourth juvenile director in Sherman County, has been out on maternity leave, but her county chair is the chair of the NORCOR board, so he's fully aware of it.
And Mr. Chair, past Gillam County Judge Laura Pryor, which everybody here knows, should be walking in the door any minute, but I fear that's not happening. Probably something on 205 has held her up. She was supposed to be here to testify. Judge Pryor has been the interim director for NORCOR two different times over the last 18 months, and so she was going to be here speaking on behalf of this.
Do you know about the Dash 1 amendments?
Chair, thank you for bringing that up. The Dash 1 amendments are the ones actually that we're supporting and would encourage the Judiciary Committee to consider. The Section 4 was put forth trying to kind of pull some things together, and we just do not believe it's needed. So the Dash 1 amendments would be what we would be supporting.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 was not in our original request to LC. It found its way in there, and so we just needed to back it out. That's what Dash 1 is all about.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Rogers, thank you for bringing this. It's an example of what a lot of people in East and on this side of the mountains don't realize what takes place, and this is a good example of leadership and the counties coming together. So I appreciate Molly and Representative Huffman bringing this forth, and I trust them both, and I think this is good legislation that should pass.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
I move the Dash 1.
We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3157.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move Dash 1s into 3157.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash 1 amendments in House Bill 3157. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair.
We're not ready to go.
Okay, you got a fiscal.
We don't have the paperwork yet. We're not going to be able to move the bill in because we don't have the fiscal information at this time. So close the work session on House Bill 3157. Open a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3341.
House Bill 3341 modifies the ability of a court to impose less than mandatory minimum sentences for certain offenses, authorizes resentencing of defendants previously ineligible for lesser sentences with consent of the district attorney. There are also Dash 1s before the committee. We do not yet have the fiscal statements on either the Dash 1s or the original bill.
John Foote, Steve Dole, and Darren Stack, please. Because of the schedule, we're going to be timing. We'd like about 3 minutes, please. Just go ahead. Anybody wants to start, just identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. I come to you today in Crime Victims United as in support of House Bill 3341, which allows increased discretion within the core principles of Measure 11 for some non-enforceable sex offenses. As most of you know, I have been a very strong supporter of Measure 11 over the years, as has Crime Victims United. I don't sit in front of you here very easily today. However, I have supported similar modifications to Measure 11 twice before, once in 1997 and once in 2001. The success of Measure 11 over the years, over the past 14 years, in significantly contributing to a 47% reduction in violent crime in Oregon, cannot be underlined too many times, especially considering in the previous years we had approximately a 700% increase in the rate of violent crime in the state. Nevertheless, our organization has consistently supported responsible efforts to fine-tune Measure 11, as experience has shown that crimes needed to be added to Measure 11 in the cases of compelling prostitution and arson in the first degree, and that guided judicial discretion needed to be allowed for certain Measure 11 offenders when certain criteria was met. HB 3341 is such a change. It reflects what has already been implemented by many district attorneys around the state in consultation with crime victims through discretionary plea agreements. It is, in times of significant financial pressures, sound fiscal policy as well, and you will see in a chart in front of you that over the years, Measure 11, if you look at the chart that I received from the Criminal Justice Commission that shows costs, based on the fact that the charging procedures would remain the same, these are the costs we've saved. It's about $130 or $135 million, or roughly $13 million a year, every year, that this is contributed back into the system by the passage of these modifications to Measure 11. Also, you'll see a chart from 2007 which shows you exactly the percentage of inmates who are receiving the Measure 11 sentence versus the downward departure that's affected not by plea agreements but by the 1049-2379 agreements. Reasonable people can differ over the exact specifics of the bill, but I believe that the core principle is that this is an area where a change is called for that cannot be questioned. It's true to the 1049 concept that the Legislative Assembly has adhered to over the years in modifying Measure 11. Last but not least, I can't sit here and tell you this is a victim's bill. It's not. This is a bill about fairness. This is a bill about justice. And this is a bill about being reasonable about our criminal justice system. However, I will give you this caveat. I've dealt with literally thousands of victims over the last number of years that I've been involved in this, and I have had victims come to me or their families saying, we wanted him punished, or we wanted this person punished, but my God, 6 years. This allows the judge, this doesn't reduce the sentences, it allows the judge to reduce the sentences in these situations. I thank you very much for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Go ahead, we'll have the panel speak.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Darian Stanford. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and I'm down here to express Multnomah County District Attorney's Office support for House Bill 3341. Chair Barker, you mentioned trying to limit things to 3 minutes. I'm going to do my best to do that, and I'm going to limit myself to a technical discussion of how this bill works, and then, of course, take questions afterwards. I apologize if I'm trying to give too much information too quickly. What I think is important to understand is what Mr. Dole just said, is let's understand what House Bill 3341 does. It expands what is commonly known as 1049 eligibility. Well, let's understand what we're really talking about. There are three concepts to understand. First of all, is a sentence that a person could get under ballot Measure 11. We all should be familiar with those. That ranges from 70 months mandatory up to 300. That's the ballot Measure 11 sentence. So you have that on the one hand. What you can do then, you also have the sentencing guidelines grid. Ballot Measure 11 removes you from this grid and gives you a specific sentence. You have the grid sentence, where you find the offender's grid block, their prior criminal history being the horizontal axis, the vertical axis being what the crime they're accused of now rates, 1 being the least serious, 11 being the most serious. So even ballot Measure 11 offenses, they also all appear on this grid as well. For example, one of the crimes we're talking about today is rape in the second degree. It's classified as a level 8. That would be 8. The sentence would range from 41 to 45 months all the way down to 16 to 18 months, depending on where the offender falls on the grid. That is the grid block sentence for rape 2. The Measure 11 sentence for rape 2, I believe, is 75 months. Now, That's the grid sentence. You also then would have what's called a dispositional departure on this grid down to probation. So if an offender, and all of the ballot measure 11 sentences that we're talking about today fall, would be prison sentences on the grid. If you are on the grid, a judge has the authority to make specific findings to go from the grid down to what's called a dispositional departure to probation. So we've got ballot measure 11, we've got the grid block prison, and then we've got a further departure on the grid all the way to probation. That's the universe of what we're talking about. Right now, under existing law, there is a mechanism. It's commonly referred to as 1049. That is not, you're not going to find that term in the law. That's the underlying Senate bill that created it. It's ORS 137.712. It allows for persons to escape, is one way to say it, or to avoid the ballot measure 11 sentence only if they're eligible. And then what you would do is go to the grid. Instead of the BM 11 sentence, you go to the grid. Let's take an example. Let's say that there is a person that is convicted of the crime of sex abuse in the first degree, which is this ballot measure 11 sentence of 75 months. What's going to happen then at sentencing is the judge is going to have to decide, all right, is this person what we refer to as 1049 eligible? That is, are they eligible under 137.712? If they are, well, then we can talk about what findings we would need to make to impose the grid block rather than the BM 11 sentence. What you must find, the factors are very similar. And for ballot measure 11, for 1049 eligibility for sex offenses, we're talking about rape in the second degree, sodomy in the second degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the second degree, and sexual abuse in the first degree. That's the one I used in my hypothetical. How is a person 1049 eligible for one of these departures? Well, the victim has to have been 12 or 13 at the time of the offense, no younger than 12. The defendant could not have had any prior enumerated serious, there's a specific list, a prior serious felony. Murder, obviously, assault in the third degree, some lesser felonies fall on that list also. Rape in the third degree, stalking, intimidation. There's a list in the law of specific priors. If you have any of them, end of the story. You are not eligible for this treatment. The defendant could not have a prior juvenile sex crime of any kind. Right now, under existing law, it says for these sex offenses, the defendant has to be no more than 5 years older than the victim. If you are 5 years and one day older, you are not eligible for this departure sentence under 1049. End of discussion. The offense could not have involved sexual contact with any more victims than just the one minor.
The lack of consent
has to be solely due to the age of the victim. If there's force in any way, shape, or form, we're not talking about these offenses. We're talking about first-degree offenses. And so those are the list of criteria. If all of those are met, if the judge finds that those are met by a preponderance of the evidence, the judge then can say, all right, you are 1049 eligible. Now the question is, do we want to depart? You don't have to. It's up to the judge. So the next question then is, once the judge determines somebody's eligible, do I go from the ballot measure 11 sentence to the grid? How do I get there? I have to find a substantial and compelling reason to justify the lesser criminal sentence. There's a specific list of factors that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission puts forward in terms of determining whether or not somebody, whether there's a substantial and compelling reason. If you're writing this down, it's at Oregon OAR 213-008-0002, sub 1, sub A. I'll just give you a couple of them. The defendant acted under duress or compulsion. The defendant has a diminished mental capacity. The offense was principally committed by somebody else, and the defendant played a relatively minor role. The defendant cooperated with the state. The defendant had been conviction-free for a long time period. Treatment is likely to be more effective than prison in reducing recidivism. One of these factors has to be found specifically by the judge to depart from ballot measure 11 to the grid. So that's how a person could go from sex abuse 1, 75 months, to a 16 to 18 month presumed prison sentence if they're an 8 on the grid and they have no priors. The last thing then that I'll mention is, under present law, a judge can go even further on 1049. If all those findings are made by the judge then can say,
I can depart further from prison to probation. How do you do that? It's called a dispositional departure, and you need to find another substantial and compelling reason, basically. That list of factors that I gave, you need to find a separate one. And that could justify a departure all the way down to probation. So that's the universe of what we're talking about. And what this bill does is it changes and expands some of the criteria to get offenders from the ballot measure 11 sentence into this universe of the grid and even possible probation. Important point to make is, like Mr. Dole said, this doesn't automatically do it at all. It would be up to a judge looking at the specific circumstances to decide, is such a departure warranted? If it's not warranted, the BM 11 departure sticks. Or if the person is, or I'm sorry, the BM 11 sentence sticks. The last thing I'll say is what this bill does. Right now, the rules are for these sex offenses. The defendant has to be no more than 5 years older than the victim at the time of the offense. If greater than that, then you are not 1049 eligible. That changes under this law, under 3341. You are eligible, being the key word. You don't automatically get it, you're eligible. Under the existing version, if the defendant is under 30. So the most egregious example would be like a 29-year-old with victims age 12 or 13. Could be eligible for a departure. Would not automatically get it in any way, shape, or form. So that universe is expanded. However, this bill says you cannot go all the way to probation. You still are going to prison unless you're within that five-year window. So if that five-year window idea is kept in this bill, but it's kept, those people can get probation. Everybody else, no. Only prison. Only the lesser prison sentence. So that is true for rape 2, sod 2, sex pen 2. For sex abuse 1, the rules are slightly different. Defendant is eligible regardless of age, but if the defendant is 30 or over, the defendant is only eligible to get the lesser prison sentence, not all the way to probation. If the defendant is 29 or younger under sex abuse 1, you can go all the way to probation. The last thing that I'll mention about for this bill, there are other factors and other elements, but in the interest of time, I'll skip over those unless there are questions. There is an amendment that we have asked for that it is not yet ready at this time, and that is to expand the create an entirely new 1049 eligibility for the crime of using a child in a display of sexually explicit conduct. Right now, nobody is ever eligible for that. Under this, the amended version, a person convicted of that offense could be eligible for a departure sentence, but only if the offender is under 21. Oh, there it is. I was incorrect. I'll have to take a look at that. But only if the offender is under 21
and the victim is at least 12
or greater. That was a lot of information. If you have any questions, I'm happy to respond or to speak with anybody.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is John Foote. I'm the DA in Clackamas County. I'm here to, first of all, share with you that the ODAA is in support of this bill generally. I want to make a couple of general remarks. The details here are very important, and Darian's done a good job of explaining them. But in essence, what these efforts are to improve the law as it applies in the everyday real life of these cases, which are very complicated. What we all worry about is that nightmare scenario where we write something that results in something that's unjust. But I think this has been done very carefully and very thoughtfully. A lot of eyes have looked at it, and I think they should continue to look at it. There might be some areas where we might be able to improve it, but we are generally in support of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Darian, we heard just earlier that Oregon experienced this 47% reduction in crimes against person, the violent type things, and I think that's great. That was the greatest of any of the 50 states when Measure 11 came in. But we got Measure 11 because there was so much inconsistency for the same set of circumstances throughout the state, and it was shown over and over and over. Multnomah County, same circumstance. You get 6 months. Klamath County, you got 2 years. There was no justice in the system. If we go to this with the discretion that's given the court, will we end up within this thicker pool of violations, the ability for the courts again to get back to where if you had, under the same circumstances and the same criminal history, the discretion of the judge, you could end up with quite a difference?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, in my opinion, the bill is narrowly crafted to try to eliminate those that sort of concern. Because people, if a person, remember, if a person has any type of history of committing this kind of behavior in the past, we're not even talking about them. They're not eligible for this treatment. So we are by and large going to be talking about people with no criminal history whatsoever. And we've tried to draft it in a way that the judge is going to have to make specific findings. And absent making those findings, they can't depart. But it will give them the flexibility in the cases that are out there that they sometimes need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Smith, go ahead and we'll work around this way.
Steve, I just want to say thanks for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, a question for one of the experts or counsel. I'm assuming that the judge's findings under existing law in this bill are reviewed for abuse of discretion. Is that the standard?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, yes, that it would be no different.
A follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Are you aware of any time a judge's findings under 1049 or has ever been overturned by the Court of Appeals?
I'm not aware of any. Representative Barton. Yeah, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, no, I'm not either.
Okay. That's sort of the good decisions that were made.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it is.
Representative Olson. Go ahead, Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You as the DA's office have the ability to file on charges. And, I mean, if you have a case where it's a Measure 11 eligibility type, crime that's been committed, you choose whether you want to go there or plead. Do you see this then kind of as a check and balance as you move forward then, that it does give discretion to the court and kind of just working more in harmony then with what you want?
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, yes, I think what this does is it gives guided discretion to make decisions that fall into the area where we can't reach it now, when the defendant, when both sides are at a loggerhead and it's either a very stiff sentence or nothing. And what we'd like to do is have some more flexibility in that kind of case for the court in conjunction. We exercise the discretion first, obviously, in our charging decisions and our negotiating position. But eventually, it would allow the court to participate in that process under certain factual circumstances, making certain factual findings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was initially quite skeptical about this, and I took time and read through it very carefully, and first I will say that I think it is narrowly drafted, which is a good thing. Secondly, I happened to have a conversation this weekend when I was home with one of our esteemed members of the bench in Deschutes County. I run into all sorts of people in the grocery store. It's amazing. But we got to talking about this, and I sort of bounced this off of him, and one of the things he reminded me of that oftentimes, as he indicated, the guilt or innocence isn't the biggest issue. It's sometimes the situation calls for a little more discretion on the part of the court, and that was the thing that he missed the most from the imposition of sentences pursuant to like ballot measure 11 that are just determinate and there is no flexibility, as there is in the sentencing grid where there's criteria for upward or downward departure. And so we had quite a interesting discussion on that, and I think I was swayed that this is not overboard. This is within the parameters and the boundaries of probably what is good common sense. So I appreciate the fact that you did tighten it and you did draw it narrowly, and I think I'm comfortable that it doesn't go too far.
Thank you.
If I could just expand upon what Chair Barker, what Representative Stigler just said. When we did this in the past, we did it out of the Attorney General's office, and we had a group of people at the table that included defense attorneys, victims, AG's people, criminal defense people, ACLU, et cetera. And so to speak, we then came into the legislature and all held hands and jumped off the cliff together. But given that, one of the things that was discussed is that the fact that the reason this is so important in second-degree crimes is because of the type of behavior, and I'm saying this, I just have to always remind myself, I'm not a lawyer, but it's the breadth of behavior that can happen under a second-degree robbery as opposed to a first-degree robbery. And in a second-degree assault as opposed to and that's the way the statutes are written. So we're talking about two different things here in a way. We're talking about statute versus sentence. Obviously, if you listen to the template that's used to determine if you have an opt-out under the 1049 concept, none of that would ever apply to a murder. You've got a deceased victim. You've got the use of a dangerous or deadly weapon. And you've got... Well, you've got a deceased victim that takes care of the significant physical injury, and if you start to apply that across the board in first degree crimes, you can come to the conclusion, obviously, to include second degree manslaughter, that this works on just these second degree crimes that we've already applied it to, and now want to expand and strengthen for the crimes discussed today. And I appreciate your time.
Okay, Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, sir, Mr. Chair. Mr. District Attorney, I heard your testimony say you generally support the bill.
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, Vice Chair Wisnant. I'm still warming up to this, is quite frankly. I think this is, there was an area which I felt really needed to be addressed, which is a little more narrow than this, but I've been reading this and thinking this is a reasonable thing to do. I trust the people that are drawing it up, who are thoughtful and being thorough about it, and that's why, generally speaking, we're supportive. While we're a little nervous about it, we think it's generally good policy.
Thanks, sir.
Hey, thank you. Yes, ma'am, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA does support the bill. We think that any opportunity to ameliorate the rigid confines of mandatory sentence provisions and allow the judiciary the discretion to craft justice in accordance with the facts and circumstances before the court is a good day, and so we support the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Barker. Representative Shields.
Gail, can I ask you a question about how this works every day in the courtroom? It's been proposed that this is really about judicial discretion, but the way this would actually work, isn't this primarily a tool to help the defense counsel and the DA get to kind of an in-between part in plea negotiations? And isn't it pretty rare that this actually gets to the case where a judge is downward departing on their own after a trial?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, and Representative Shields, my experience with Measure 11 and my understanding from those who are still practicing is that they're still very heavily negotiated resolutions. It's the rare case that actually ends up with pitching the whole thing to the jury. Usually by the time you have a Measure 11 charge on the table, it can be so onerous that it's the very rare client who will risk, even if they suggest that they do have a triable case, it's the rare client that really will take that risk before a jury. And so most of these resolutions are negotiated and very frequently stipulated. And so those opportunities where the court gets to weigh in on 1049s, the discretionary aspect of going back to the guidelines, those are the rare cases, not the bulk of them.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Quinteros, Christine Herman, and David Rogers, please.
I didn't
And our timer isn't working, so I'll ask you, please, yes yourself for 3 minutes.
Sure.
A little egg timer. Good thing we're not cooking today, but go ahead, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Terry Quinteros. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We work with all 49 nonprofit domestic and sexual violence organizations across the state. The coalition has been in existence for 30 years, and we're a part of a nationwide network of coalitions that provide that support to direct service providers. I'm here to oppose House Bill 3341, and also, just as a bit of information, I just received the information of how extensive this bill is during this particular hearing, and I based my testimony on Sex Abuse 1. So looking at the bill, it looks like myself and others agree that blanket laws, such as Measure 11, are not helpful for public safety. Situations, as it's already been mentioned, can be very complicated, and every victim deserves to have their entire story heard in the courts. With that, I'm here to say that this is not the place to begin Measure 11 reform. Implying that a 12, 13, or 14-year-old can consent to sexual contact with an adult is dangerous. It implies and sends the message to these kids that they are partially, if not fully, at fault for the abuse that they have experienced, which makes it less likely for them to come forward and access any kind of help. Regarding reform, the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, as well as other groups, such as the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, are willing to help provide information and support regarding actual reform that not only provides victim safety, but public safety, and also helps save the state money. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Herman.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the executive director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. And I want to start out by saying I wanted to just put out on the record that I appreciate the efforts on behalf of the proponents of this bill to include the Sexual Assault Task Force and other victim service agencies. However, we have not had, I don't believe, an adequate opportunity to address some of the concerns that the task force and other victim service agencies have with the current bill. I agree with Ms. Quinteros that this is not the place to reform Measure 11, not at the expense of 12 and 13-year-old victims of sex crimes. The concept that there may be some exceptions within these particular crimes is, there's no other way around it but then to recognize that it's rooted in the idea that 12 and 13-year-old kids sometimes have it coming, that they sometimes are at least implicit in their abuse. There's also, the because of the types of crimes that are chosen here for potential exceptions, there's also a value judgment on whether abuse and trauma are more damaging to kids based on whether penetration occurs. That's not the reports that we hear back from victims. Trauma is not based on particular sex acts. It's based on the relationship and the abuse of trust. The current 5-year exception that's in the law, the 1049 exception that's been spoken of, seems to cover the least egregious cases. Those cases three of a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old, a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old. The current bill anticipates exceptions for a 12-year-old and a 45-year-old under Sex Abuse 1. For Sex Abuse 1, a 12-year-old and a 29-year-old, the 29-year-old could be sentenced to probation. I can guarantee you that this will result in an examination not just of the defendant's act, but on the worth of the victim. And I wasn't here when Measure 11 was discussed among the voters, but my guess is that, as Representative Krieger noted, discretion tends to affect people of color, young people, people of lesser economic status in a more egregious way. And that will certainly be the case if judges are allowed to determine the level of guilt of the offender by looking at the victim, which is what these sorts of things would encourage. There are, I also wanted to point out, and Representative Olson touched on this, that prosecutors are in that
enviable position of being able to exercise discretion in charging. And so when there are those cases that seem to the prosecutor to be less egregious, there's a very easy way to get outside of Measure 11. It's by choosing a different charge. You can go with an attempted case to get the case out of Measure 11. You can come up with other ways to negotiate the case that take it out of Measure 11. But like has been pointed out, I think Representative Cameron pointed out earlier, the few cases that end up after a jury verdict with a judge on his or her own making these decisions are not the cases where when a jury has found a person guilty, where the judge should have the opportunity to basically go back and say, what you found this person guilty of, I don't think he's guilty of that much. I think he's guilty of significantly less. We would like to work towards a compromise, and as I mentioned, the proponents of the bill have indicated a desire to do that as well. I understood there would not be a work session today. If there is, my position is we are in opposition to the bill. If there is not a work session today, I would certainly hope that we can work together towards some form of compromise. And I have every reason to believe that the proponents are willing to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Rogers.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is David Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. And I have to say that this is actually incredibly difficult testimony for me to provide, and so I appreciate your patience. The proponents of Measure 11 have done an amazing job creating an environment in which even the mention of Measure 11 reform seems like sacrilege in the state. And in absence of actually good evidence, the myth has been created that even the slightest change to Measure 11 is going to unleash a tidal wave of carnage across the state. And so yet I sit here today testifying on a bill that's being advocated for by, you know, Oregon's kind of tough on crime lobby. And not only is it a Measure 11 reform, it's a retroactive Measure 11 reform. And so, you know, I'm frankly not sure whether or not I should be afraid for my life or whether or not I am somehow have been transported to some bizarre alternative universe when thinking about the political landscape around this bill. We're talking about a very narrow, it creates some discretion for a narrow set of circumstances when there are sex offenses against a 12 or 13-year-old victim. One thing I will say is that Partnership for Safety and Justice has consistently had a position that opposes mandatory minimum sentences, and because we think it's bad policy, and that the problem with mandatory minimum sentences is that it doesn't allow for judicial discretion, and it's a cookie-cutter approach to justice, and God forbid any one of us or our loved ones would actually find ourselves in the system, but if that was the case, we'd certainly want some judicial discretion to look at the individual circumstances of the case. And given that, we believe that rigid one-size-fits-all sentencing structures are a poor approach to justice. A bill like House Bill 3341 that does allow for some discretion is something that, from a policy perspective, we support. That said, I have to say the politics around this bill are actually disturbing. And, you know, I'm going to admit that this issue is actually personal and not just organizational. My sister was a victim of childhood sex abuse. And, you know, actually there are a number of people that are near and dear to my heart who are also victims of childhood sex abuse. And, you know, although at this point in her life my sister would certainly identify as a survivor and not as a victim, you know, the abuse that she suffered as a child had a profound impact on her life. And well over a decade after she suffered the abuse, you know, she was still struggling to cope with that victimization. I have seen the damage that childhood sex abuse can cause. And, you know, it's worth mentioning that this bill actually deals with sex abuse not just, not for children, but for victims who are in their adolescence. And adolescents who have been victimized actually show a wider variety of physical and mental health issues than people who have been victimized during childhood or as an adult. And the research has actually shown that that's the case, both from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency and the National Center on Victims of Crime. So I have to say that it disturbs me that the proponents of this bill, who defended Measure 11 so adamantly, are willing to give legislators a free pass on a retroactive change to Measure 11, and this is the place that we want to start, to focus in on sex offenses directed at adolescent victims. And, you know, clearly we do need some flexibility in terms of the sentencing around mandatory minimums, because individual circumstances of cases matter. And there are some circumstances, I would imagine, under the offenses included in this bill, where perhaps the mandatory minimum sentence seems unjust. But, you know, to think that somehow this set of offenses is somehow unique in the larger set of Measure 11 offenses, I think is incredibly misleading. And the range of cases across the spectrum of Measure 11 offenses, you can point to cases where increased judicial discretion would have much more appropriately served justice. And when I think that Measure 11 automatically treats youth, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, as adults as soon as they're charged with a Measure 11 sentence, that's a great place to start when thinking about Measure 11 reform, given the fact that all of the research around the country shows that automatically treating youth as adults within the criminal justice system is bad for public safety. They're actually more likely to create future crime when sentenced as adults, and yet we're currently doing that. And in fact, the proponents of this bill have consistently been unwilling to look at even a second look for youth convicted of as an adult via Measure 11, even for second degree offenses. But here we are looking at this bill. We don't want to look at second look for youth, even though it's good public safety policy. 66% of registered voters in Oregon support it. So I'm confused by this bill, frankly. And, you know, I will say this, that there are several things you can consistently expect from Partnership for Safety and Justice. You can expect that our policy proposals are going to be driven by research. You can expect that we'll thoughtfully weigh issues from multiple perspectives. And you can expect that our core values and policy framework will be consistently applied. That said, despite mixed feelings created by the context and questions surrounding this bill, we actually support the modest discretion that this bill creates. But yet we do wonder what's really motivating this bill. We wonder why the proponents of this bill can honestly think that there are no other people serving sentences other than other Measure 11 sentences for which increased judicial discretion would serve justice more appropriately. And since this bill is actually getting the time and consideration from this committee, we wonder if, in fact, we could get the same time and consideration for a modest but meaningful proposal to second look for youth convicted of a Measure 11 sentence.
You're about 7 minutes, so if you could wrap it up.
Okay. So, you know, we hope that you're less confused by this bill than we are, and I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Herman, a quick question for you. It was unclear. Are you testifying? I recognize you're the executive director of the Attorney General's Task Force on Sexual Assault. Are you testifying also on behalf of Attorney General Kroeber and the Department of Justice, or in your personal capacity, or in your? Can you clarify that for me, please?
Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Barton. No, I do not represent Department of Justice. I, in fact, work for a private nonprofit.
Oh.
It's a little bit confusing with that name, but I don't speak for Mr. Kroeber now.
Thank you. I did not know that. I never knew that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christine, I have two questions of you. One, you kind of gave the impression to me that you had a possibility of some type of amendments or some concept that you'd like to move forward in plugging into this bill. Can you kind of share with us a little bit what those are?
Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Olson. I would be interested in discussing with the proponents of the bill some further restrictions on the ages that are outlined right now. I think 30 is too old to be in this category of potential exceptions. I think for sexual abuse one, having absolutely no age restriction is not acceptable to the task force. I didn't mention earlier, at least I don't think I did, that I think there are some good parts of this bill. There are some exceptions to exceptions, if you will, for defendants who would also be considered mandatory child abuse reporters.
And so I do think that there are ways that we can come to some agreement. I just, frankly, have not had the opportunity to work with them on that yet.
Okay, and then just one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Christine, are you familiar with the Rodriguez case out of Washington County?
I am.
Okay. How do you see this working there? Because that seems to me like that was just a sad situation which occurred. And this whole concept here where we're going to move forward with this bill could have plugged in and helped that.
Thank you for the question. I will admit that I'm familiar in general terms with that case. I don't know it specifically. What I do know is that A, policy can't be built on one case, and B, that I think it's dangerous to do that anyway, and B, that my understanding is that the jury was submitted several charges. She was found not guilty on most charges, and found guilty of this one. I believe it was sexual abuse one or rape two. I believe it's sexual abuse one. In that case, there may have been some way to circumvent the extreme sentence. This is what I'm talking about, though. These are the types of cases where the jury has come back with a verdict, and this bill would allow the judge to look beyond the verdict and determine basically facts, what facts are relevant for sentencing. And I know that that is a large part of what a judge does. I think that in a case that if both sides agree that a 75-month sentence would be too long, would not be just, that there are ways to go about coming to agreements that would allow for a lesser sentence. I will always fall on the side of the prosecutor exercising proper discretion. That's what the whole setup with the executive branch was to do. And if we don't trust our prosecutors to do that, then that's a different question altogether.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is one way to get at those type of outrageous cases like we've had in the Rodriguez case. I just wanted to let the committee know that there are other ways to deal with this, and one is moving its way through the Senate right now, which would put more of this, more of the power in the hands of juries. In the case of Ms. State v. Rodriguez, where you got a 90-month sentence where you had a 90-month sentence, this would allow the juries to be informed of what the likely sentence would be before they deliberate. And I think you would end up with another path to justice that wouldn't be, frankly, so creepy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a comment that the oddball set of flipped testimonies that we heard today are to me an example of the political structural defect that we have in public safety. That it seems to me, and what do I know? I'm new. It seems to me that we have a habit, even more than in the couple other committees I sit on, of as soon as one side, in this session for me it seemed a little bit more often to be law enforcement, but I have the impression that it would be the same dynamic if the shoe were on the other foot. As soon as one side feels that it has enough votes to get out of committee, went on the floor, that's the end of the conversation. And that we don't have a well enough developed set of habits to put each other and one another on the same side of the table approaching a common problem, that common problem being how to keep our communities more safe and how to do it within the resources that we have. And I merely want to use this chance to say that in the hope that among the people listening, we think about how we can make smarter, more coalition-friendly, more multi-stakeholder approached responses to our public safety planning and policy making.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3341. Open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3092.
House Bill 3092 creates the crime of insurance fraud that permits a court to order restitution to an insurer for value of benefit obtained illegally. It requires a prosecutor to notify certain public agencies if a person has a conviction for insurance fraud, and exempts a person providing information about suspected insurance fraud from civil liability for providing the information. House Bill 3092 does not yet have a fiscal impact statement. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Alan Haskins, Dana McDonald, and Robin Wheeler. Try to time it at about 3 minutes because we're getting behind schedule.
Absolutely.
So just identify yourself. Whoever wants to go first, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alan Haskins. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the National Insurance Crime Bureau. With me also today is Dana McDonald, our Area 2 Director of Operations for NICB. Area 2 covers 8 western states, including the state of Oregon. The NICB is a national nonprofit organization supported by approximately 1,000 property and casualty insurance companies. Working with our members and law enforcement, we investigate organized criminal conspiracies dealing with insurance fraud and vehicle theft. Because of our interest in insurance fraud issues, we want to express our strong support for House Bill 3092. Our investigative experience of questionable claims referrals from our member companies show that insurance fraud continues to be a rampant problem in Oregon. Oregon State Insurance Companies reported 1,262 questionable claims to NICB in 2008. Since 2006, Oregon has had an estimated 20% increase in questionable claims reported by our member companies. For background, Oregon is one of only 3 states that does not have an insurance fraud law, and one of only 6 states that does not have an insurance fraud bureau. This makes it very difficult to fight insurance fraud and forces law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, and NICB to rely on a handful of inadequate existing statutes to achieve prosecutions of these crimes. Oregon does, however, have a precedent of identifying and enacting laws that target a specific crime and has had success enforcing those statutes. Criminal statute ORS 165.90, making a false claim of health care payments, was deliberately drafted so that it would apply to Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurance, private health insurance. This law is not applicable to private property and casualty insurance. Oregon state law, enforcement prosecutors, and insurance consumers do not have the benefit of this type of law and must rely on a handful of unrelated statutes to fit a round peg into a square hole. We have documented numerous instances of staged auto accidents, medical mill operations, traffic and stolen vehicles, body shop fraud, glass shop, rate evasion schemes in the state of Oregon. To assist the state and minimize any fiscal impact to the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Fraud Division, we offer our organization as a conduit for reporting of, and our resources to assist in identifying, investigating, and deterring insurance fraud. We are well aware of the fiscal impact concerns that a new law may have on the state of Oregon. History has shown in 47 other states that enacting insurance fraud laws do not fill up the jails or prisons, nor create a court system backlog of insurance fraud cases. But what did happen is consumers were protected, criminals were targeted, and a loophole in the criminal justice system was closed, and a deterrent to committing the crime of insurance fraud was present. The lack of a specific insurance fraud law has hampered the efforts to investigate and prosecute insurance fraud in the state of Oregon. The proposed legislation addresses the most serious deficiency that the state has in trying to tackle this problem. We believe that the creation of an insurance fraud law will be the start of providing a necessary framework to begin to address Oregon's ever-increasing insurance fraud problem. In addition, it will provide the necessary venue for the reporting of suspected insurance fraud activities by citizens, insurers, law enforcement, and other agencies, helping to identify specific trends and patterns of all types of fraud. Without an insurance fraud law to focus attention on investigation and prosecution, prosecuting insurance fraud, both a social and economic cost to Oregon citizens and businesses will continue to escalate. As the National Insurance Crime Bureau supports a strong anti-fraud laws and believes an insurance fraud law in the state of Oregon is a necessary tool to fight insurance fraud activity. We fully support House Bill 3092 and appreciate your consideration of our views. I'll let Dana McDonald give you a couple comments and then Mr. Robinson.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dana McDonald. For the last 7 years, I've been employed as a director of operations for Area 2 for the National Insurance Crime Bureau. I began my employment with NICB following my retirement from the FBI after a 30-year career. The NICB, on an operational level, works with all levels of law enforcement on behalf of the public and our member companies in an effort to reduce insurance crime and vehicle theft. We have two experienced NICB agents employed in the state of Oregon working these matters on a daily basis. Insurance fraud continues to be a major crime problem in Oregon that is not being adequately addressed. This directly affects the quality of life for the citizens of Oregon by attracting a criminal element that becomes involved in more than just insurance crimes. Criminal elements are well aware that Oregon has a soft reputation on insurance crime, as evidenced by the fact that Oregon is one of only three states in the nation that does not have an insurance crime statute on the books. Oregon is also surrounded by states that not only have an insurance fraud statute, but also have an insurance fraud bureau that has dedicated prosecutors and investigators handling insurance fraud matters. Oregon ranks number 2 among the 8 states that I supervise in connection with referrals of questionable claims. More troubling is the fact that in the last couple of years, Oregon has been increasing over 20% per year in the referrals that we are receiving. Our investigation and referrals reflect clearly that Oregon is experiencing a significant increase in organized insurance fraud and vehicle theft activity. NICB fully supports House Bill 3092 as the creation of an insurance fraud law is urgently needed to help tackle the increasing insurance fraud problem that Oregon is experiencing. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett, please.
What statute would insurance fraud currently be prosecuted under, and why is that inadequate to the task?
What prosecutors use is like theft by deception. And the problem is, and even like aggravated theft, even like on a vehicle, on aggravated theft, to get all you can charge on a vehicle is a C felony. Aggravated theft is over $10,000, but the way the statute reads right now, the vehicles are exempt. So somebody can steal a $200,000 Maserati, and all they would get was a C felony charge. The biggest problem, quite frankly, is a lot of prosecutors and also law enforcement are even unaware that there's no insurance fraud statute on the books. And when cases are brought forward, the first thing they mention is they consider it a civil problem, that it should, there's civil remedies. That's the first thing they ask. And, what our history has shown, that insurance fraud is the number 2 crime as far as dollar loss behind income tax evasion. And so it is a significant loss to not only the citizens, but also the businesses in Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on Representative Garrett's question. I still don't understand how the current statute on the books isn't adequate to the problem. To the extent, the only kind of, I felt, inadequacy in the current statute would be that it doesn't apply to certain automotive.
Theft by deception, the problem is you could also have a case where there's misapplication and fraud, and if it doesn't reach the level on the specific wording of deception, then it doesn't get charged. And that's why all the other states in the United States have specific insurance fraud laws to lay out, you know, and it's another tool for prosecutors to use. That's why. Now, you know, in my 37 years in law enforcement, there's plenty of laws on the books, and people have become very creative with how they can charge a case. You know, I have a lot of experience federally. You can basically take any case you want and charge it as a civil rights violation. But that's not the way the laws are set up, and that's not the way that you should hamstring both law enforcement and prosecutors in how to charge a case. And that's why you need a specific insurance fraud law on the books here, especially when you're surrounded now by states that are aggressively prosecuting these, and therefore you just become a softer target. That's the reason why.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McDonald, could you give me an example of organized insurance fraud?
Well, organized insurance fraud is you would have a staged accident case, or you would have a number of individuals involved in medical fraud where you not only have a runner who would line somebody up to go through an accident, and then you would have either a crooked attorney or a crooked doctor that would be involved. And what they end up doing then is just overbilling the insurance company for either services not rendered or they weren't injured. You have those type of cases. Other cases, you have organized theft cases where you have organized rings or stealing vehicles, using these in staged accidents, stripping the vehicles, changing the VIN numbers on them. You end up with vehicles on the road that are not safe, that are causing problems for your citizens. Those type of cases, sir.
Thank you.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes, I have.
And are you in support then of the Dash ones?
I'm
assuming the amendments that I submitted, yes.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Wheeler.
Chair Barker, I'm a member of the committee. My name is Robin Wheeler, and I have worked in State Farm Insurance for 30 years. And in 14 of those years, I have been in the Special Investigations Unit. I could tell you many stories about fraud activity, but because of time, I will tell you one that illustrates many. I handled a claim with a woman who had gone and purchased two insurance policies from our agent, one an auto policy and one a renter's policy. Thereafter, she began to make claims, and there were concerns that were brought about on the third claim, and it came to me to investigate. My investigation revealed this. The claim was fictitious. She was not who she said she was. She had taken out the policies in a different name, and she was not from the state of Oregon. I called her up, and I told her I wanted to meet her again and discuss her claim. She would only meet me in a coffee shop, so that's where I met her. And I confronted her with what my investigation revealed, and she confessed. And then I asked her why. Why are you here, and why do you do this? Because she was a college-educated woman, very capable. She smiled at me, and she told me, I am from Arizona, as you know, and I did insurance fraud there, and I went to jail. When I got out of jail, I wanted to continue with my profession of insurance fraud. I looked around. I wanted to stay on the West Coast, so that is why I'm here. And she brought her friends with her. And as I sat there over coffee, bitter coffee, an ugly conversation listening to her, I realized that our citizens are being taken advantage of. We are vulnerable. And I also realized that insurance fraud is a crime. I am in strong favor of this bill, and I hope that you too will acknowledge that insurance fraud is a crime and our citizens are being taken advantage of every day. It is the citizens of Oregon, hardworking citizens who pay their premiums, who are having to bear this activity. I ask that you shut down this activity. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. What impact did, assuming there are other states who enacted an insurance fraud crime recently, what impact on enforcement did it have on those states? And related question, what tangible impact might we anticipate it having here if we adopted some version of this bill?
Well, most recently, Washington State created a fraud law and a fraud bureau, and they saw at least some significant reductions in premiums. They've also, through civil actions, working with the fraud law, recovered $18 million, I believe, in the past couple of years. There are other states. Yeah, there's two states that do not have fraud laws, as Alabama and Virginia. Virginia works off a very small group of criminal statutes, and Alabama, I'm actually going to be there soon to address their committee that's addressing the same issue as well. But all the other states have insurance fraud laws, and some are more aggressive in prosecuting and investigating than others. But the ones that do, it is a deterrent, and a lot of the states have seen reductions in premiums as that deterrent.
And as an example, Mr. Haskins gave on Washington, that the state of Washington now, when I went there, when I came 7 years ago, they had tremendous auto theft rates. They had an insurance fraud law, but they didn't have an insurance fraud bureau. Since then, you know, there's been concerted efforts by prosecutors and law enforcement to fight insurance fraud and vehicle theft. For the first time in the 7 years I've been there, they've dropped out of our top ten list for auto thefts. Auto thefts are down. They've targeted a number of organized groups that are committing insurance fraud. In fact, we have an agent assigned, you know, that works with the Insurance Fraud Bureau up there, and it's made a tremendous difference. As you've probably seen, you probably have the same problems down here with some of these street racers. There was a lot of problems in the Seattle area where street racers would be stealing cars for the parts, jacking the engines up on these vehicles, and they would be racing on the freeway. And we had a number of very tragic incidences where people were killed because of that. We haven't had that, you know, in the last year and a half, 2 years, because of the concentrated effort. And that would not have occurred unless there was a real emphasis by the legislature to back insurance fraud, to get the laws on the books and the Insurance Fraud Bureau in place. And it's really made a difference. And that's why, to me, I think it's very important that all of you take a real hard look at this, because you need this. You're one of only three states left, and even Virginia, who doesn't have an insurance fraud statute on the books, they actually have an insurance fraud bureau that, yes, is using some other statute, not anything that you have here. And so you're really in a minority here. And, you know, the criminal element, they hit the insurance companies because where's the money? It's in the insurance, you know, industry. They pay. And who ends up paying is you pay with the type of people that come here and the money out of your pockets. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Next, Sean Miller and Brian Miller, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in support of House Bill 3092. And the Property Casualty Insurance Association is a trade organization of PNC companies that do about 40% of the policies in the state of Oregon. And, you know, as stated earlier, you know, Oregon is currently one of only three states that doesn't have a specific insurance fraud law. And, you know, all the states that surround Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California all do have the law. And recently in Washington, Idaho, as you heard, added fraud bureaus to their existing fraud laws. And I think to add an additional comment that was stated earlier, I think on Representative Smith's question of some of the immediate impacts, when the state of Washington did put together their fraud bureau, the insurance commissioner and a special investigation unit that uncovered an estimated $1.8 million in fraud in the first 18 months of existence. And so it is out there. It does occur. And in Oregon, I know it is a costly crime. and this crime increases insurance premiums that consumers pay each year in Oregon. And so we're here today, Mr. Chairman, to support House Bill 3092, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Miller, here today on behalf of Farmers Insurance Group. Rather than restate and rehash much of what you've already heard, I'll simply state that as the second largest personal lines insurer in the state, Farmers is certainly supportive of the NICB's efforts to pass an insurance fraud law here in Oregon, and we're certainly supportive of the passage of House Bill 3092. I've distributed a document created by the Insurance Information Institute, which I hope will provide each of you with some additional information just about the current state of affairs with insurance fraud to some degree here in Oregon, but particularly on a national basis. And I, too, would be happy to answer any questions if you can.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to need some help with this. Clearly, I'm opposed to insurance fraud. It's utterly unacceptable. But I'm just thinking, by creating a new crime, essentially, I could see two reasons why that would happen. Number A, if that crime were to have different elements than the current statutes on the books, such as larceny by deception or any other. No. Is there a distinct element here that this crime captures that the other is somehow lacking in the other one? And I don't actually see that in the statute. Or B, if we wanted to have a different sentencing, essentially, category of crime for the sentencing grid. And that makes sense if we somehow think that insurance fraud is more appropriate, somehow more reprehensible conduct than other kinds of larceny by fraud, be it identity theft or anything else. And I think we all agree that it's, although very bad, is it intrinsically worse than other kinds of larceny by deceptions? Or is there another reason I'm not thinking of why we want to treat this as a different crime than any other larceny by deception?
Well, as you can see, as we glance at each other, neither of us are claims professionals, so it'd be difficult for us to give you the answer that I think might answer that question. Speaking for Farmers Insurance, I don't see that we feel insurance fraud is any worse or any better than larceny, for instance. But as it's been described to me, I think the thresholds and the current law just makes it very difficult to prosecute an actual insurance fraud case. And but beyond that, I apologize for not being able to provide any additional detail.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. If law enforcement professional prosecutor could explain to me why this crime would help them do their job, I'd love to learn that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we were looking into that, and I think the prosecutors are the ones we need to talk to.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for my energy today. It was a nice weekend full of vigor this afternoon. So we're one of 47 states that has no specified crime of insurance fraud, but we're also one of 41 states that has no first-party right of private action for holding you guys honest. So my own impression is, you know, we probably shouldn't give to Peter and take from Paul, or just give to Peter and not to Paul. It's hard for me to think that we should hold you guys, you know, not if what's happening in Oregon is we're just sort of not paying attention to insurance enough. My favorite thing is not to give you guys a big prize and, like, screw the people that might be getting screwed, but sort of, you know, be a little more balanced than that.
You stole my...
I didn't put him up to that.
Yeah. If I may comment, as Representative Barton smiled, we are working with Representative Barton on
yeah.
this particular issue. Representative
yeah, so I'm a no on this until we get that.
Okay, thank you, panel.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Freeman. Just a second. You remember about two or 3 years ago, DHS was $72 million in the hole. They did some looking around, found the state had $24 million worth of fraud that they found just like that. Well, I don't know what they did with all those people that were committing that fraud, but what they were doing is they were limiting the number of legitimate people that we could put on those programs that legitimately needed it. I'd like to know, just, you know, maybe we need to have staff check to find out with DHS, what did they do with ever how many people there were? Could they prosecute them under anything, or did anything happen to them? And could have they been prosecuted if we'd have this?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, I call Gail Meyer and John Schultz, please. And Mr. Schultz, if you'd go ahead and just go first and let Ms. Meyer finish wrap up for us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, part of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I'll be very brief. My role here today is to make sure you're aware that there is law in our Oregon Revised Statutes in Chapter 656. Actually, there's a couple of references to fraud or making false statements. And that, to cut to the chase, under 656.990, any person who knowingly makes any false statement, and there's quite a long list, and I'll cut down to the penalty, or submits a false claim report is punishable upon conviction by imprisonment for a term of not more than 1 year, or by a fine of not more than 1,000, or both. And without going into quite a bit more detail, I just wanted to make sure the committee is aware that there is a law already for workers' compensation fraud. And as the chair knows, I spoke to you last week about this, and our recommendation is that if any law goes forward, we take a very close look at what's already on the books for workers' compensation and make sure that we don't set up conflicting laws. And it would be very one way to avoid that would be to just exempt workers' compensation from any bill, since a law already exists. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. You're being passed out a chart that I did just last night on existing statutes and some of the elements of the existing statutes. And Representative Barker, you might find this informing because what this bill does that's different than existing statutes is that it has no intentionality requirement and no material fact requirement. It simply states that it's a knowing crime, but it's dispensed with any requirement that there be an intent to deceive or an intent to deprive. And there, it dispenses with any requirement that it be with respect to a material fact. And, you know, it's just sort of hornbook law in criminal jurisprudence that fraud is an intentional crime, and this statute has dispensed with that element. So that may explain your point as to why they would want something new. More, not less. I will truncate my comments. I will simply say that we certainly don't have a problem with the existence of an insurance fraud bureau that would help coordinate existing provisions, and I'm not saying that there isn't some future statute or bill that wouldn't be tailored specifically to address these issues, and we'd be happy to be of assistance, but we hope this is regarded as a work in progress.
Okay, thank you. Any further question? Any question?
Yeah.
Representative Olson.
I just have a quick question of John. Okay, the statute that you referred to, ORS 656-990, on penalties regarding workman's compensation, do you know what the element is for culpable mental state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, no, I do not.
Well, I point out to you, it's knowingly. It's not intentional. Just a thought.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. There's no further questions. Thanks. Okay, so let's look at them later. Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 3092 and open a public hearing. I'm sorry, a work session on, I'll put down here first. 2401.
It was first heard back on the 16th of February. It expands the definition of assault in the third degree to include assault with dangerous substances on a public safety officer. We have had some changes. You have a dash 3 amendment in front of you, and what the dash 3 amendment does is bifurcate. So you have public safety officer, and for the purposes of a public safety officer, the dangerous substance would be blood, urine, semen, or feces. And then we're leaving the other portion, the staff member of a Department of Corrections facility, is still as it is currently in the statute, which is saliva, blood, urine, semen, and feces. We have a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact on the dash threes.
No fiscal.
Minimal, no statement issued.
We're supposed to wait.
It may.
Yeah, that's okay. This has a referral, subsequent referral of Ways and Means. We have the dash three amendments before us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnat.
The dash three is in the House Bill 2401.
Representative Wisnat moves the dash three is in the House Bill 2401. Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnat.
I move House Bill 2401 with the dash threes with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Passed to Ways and Means. Did I say that right?
Mr. Chair? Yes.
What was the fiscal on this?
Which I don't think was anticipated by the Speaker's office.
Withdraw the motion, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. I want you to close the work session on House Bill 2401. Open a work session on House Bill 2874. And Ms. Meyer, you wanted to speak on that one, I believe.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is in respect to House Bill 2874. You heard the proponents last week. This would create a rights of crime victims in criminal cases as to a speedy disposition, both at the trial phase and in the appellate phase. OCDLA weighs in opposition to this bill, and we make 3 points. Number one, the bill as drafted right now before you does not read as the proponents intended. As it currently reads, it is a one-sided bill that protects only the state. If you look at lines 12 and 13 of the bill, it talks about the sole remedy is for the trial of the proceeding to promptly occur, and then it states this remedy may not be imposed if the remedy would impair the ability of the state to prepare or locate witnesses. It makes no reference to the ability of the defense to prepare or locate witnesses. I'm told by the proponents they intended to have a protection in here for the accused. There was some mishap down in Legislative Council's office. I've asked them to amend the bill so that you can vote on it in accordance with the way they intended to read. And I don't know if there's an amendment in the works yet or not, but I would ask the committee to ask the proponents to please prepare the bill to read as it should read before it's moved. I'd also suggest to the committee that creating a new right now in this bill is a bit in conflict with what's going on over in the Senate right now. There's a very large omnibus crime victims' rights bill that's coming out of the Senate, and that's Senate Bill 233. It is a 27-page bill. It attempts to codify procedures for crime victims to enforce their rights that exist in criminal cases. What it does also is that it creates a task force, and it's going to be populated with 9 different people to be chaired by the Attorney General. And they are going to be monitoring the implementation and effectuation of crime victims' rights in criminal cases, and there's going to be a detailed complaint process. So I would suggest that rather than create new crime victims' rights now, that we take a look at what's coming from the Senate in the omnibus crime victims' rights bill and have this new right be considered within the confines of that and addressed at the task force. I will say that with respect to that Senate bill, that was an instance when all the stakeholders were at the table. The Attorney General was at the table. The Judicial Department was at the table. So were the defense lawyers and the DAs. That's not the instance here with this bill. So none of the stakeholders have been at the table on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Is this particular issue covered in that bill?
It is not, but the point of it is the task force and the complaint process does allow for a more open-ended notion that it will be addressing the implementations and the complaints that crime victims do have. I will note that one of our chief concerns with House Bill 2874, the bottom line is we really don't know how the rubber hits the road here. We're really not exactly sure what this will do. Not all delays in trials are because the defense is asking for it. The state will frequently get a continuance of a trial over the objection of the accused. The accused is ready to go. The state wants the continuance. Sometimes it's the court. There's no available courtrooms. So this, right now the judges are doing a really difficult but good job at trying to accommodate competing needs. This would be an instance when you would create a third voice or a third entity in the courtroom in a two-party system. So our suggestion is that we simply defer this until we consider and take a look at the Senate bill coming over and the task force that it incorporates.
Okay, thank you, Judge Lipscomb.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Lipscomb. I'm here today as the Executive Director of MCAD, the Marion County Association of Defenders, which is the primary indigent defense group representing indigent defendants in Marion County. Excuse me. I'm here to ask that if this bill goes forward, it goes forward with an amendment that would give it a balanced approach. Essentially what this bill is a bill that creates a new specific right with respect to victims, and then it hands to the court the duty of enforcing that right by moving along trials with dispatch. But it includes within that direction to the court, at lines 12 and 13 under the bill as submitted, this language. This remedy may not be imposed if the remedy would impair the ability of the state to prepare and locate witnesses. I met with my board of directors Thursday last, and I mentioned to them that this bill was pending, and I'd been asked to come over and speak to you about it, and I told them that my concern was is that there's no balance here in the message, and that if this branch of government wants to send a message to another branch of government, it probably should or probably would want to do that in a balanced fashion. So what I would suggest is the insertion of the following language immediately at the end of line 13 to add this provision. This right shall not affect the defendant's due process rights to adequately prepare and present a defense, nor impair the right of the accused to a fair and impartial hearing in accordance with the Oregon and the United States constitutions.
Okay, isn't that already implicit? I mean, in my reading of the bill, it just says that I go and say, Your Honor, I need a speedy trial. This thing's going on too long. And if the defense says, you know, we have to do A, B, and C, that my request to speed it up certainly wouldn't go over the Constitution, either of Oregon or the United States, in asking for a speedy trial. I see this bill as just some way for somebody to let the court know that they need to get it moving for their personal whatever.
Mr. Chair, I understand your position. I think it's always a good idea to be clear when one branch of government speaks to another and not to rely on implicit assumptions. But I understand your position.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair. Your Honor, can we, if we've added that amendment, could we move the bill? The judicial branch would not oppose?
He's not judicial
branch. I'm not here as a representative of the judicial branch. I retired from the bench on June 30th. At that time, I took a part-time job working for the Indigent Defense Group here in Marion County. I express no opinion on behalf of either the Marion County Circuit Court or the Judicial Department. It's simply not my job any longer, and I apologize if I wasn't clear about that.
My mistakes. Mr. Chair, I think we heard some compelling testimony that this is an important issue. I'm not sure I want to defer it to the
task force.
To another task force.
Set it aside.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is this a case where it might benefit us to hear from somebody representing the judicial branch? We talked earlier in the session about how it might be beneficial to talk to the judges about some of our policy choices might affect the situation on the ground, and this might be an example of
legislative intent.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from somebody.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate your okay. Mr. Baloof, could you come up for a minute?
Mr. Chair, before we do, is it your intent to try to move this today? Because I do have some concerns. I'd probably be a no vote.
Okay, I won't move it today. Okay. You need to get going. Thank you. Mr. Luther, does this bill read as was intended when it was brought forward?
Actually, when I drafted the bill, I included a provision that was similar to the provision that Judge Lipscomb suggests, and actually, I'm the drafter of the bill. I'm a law professor at Lewis and Clark College and a national expert on crime victim law, and I've drafted this and negotiated it with various parties. My sentence disappeared from the bill. I'm not sure why. I make the assumption that it disappeared in Ledge Council for the very reason you articulate. So while I have no opposition to the judge's language going in, it is absolutely true as an operation of law that that language has no legal effect. The Constitution's always trump statutes. This is a statute. The defense always wins in that regard. So if you feel it is useful to remind the trial judge that they have a higher obligation of the Constitution, then I would recommend that you amend the bill. As to the omnibus bill in the Senate, I'm intimately familiar with that. I was chair of the Attorney General's Task Force on Crime Victim Compliance Matters, and it was out of that task force that came the amendment to the Oregon Constitution that was voted out of both houses of the legislature unanimously without one negative no vote to the people and passed. And that omnibus bill is simply about creating procedures which enforce constitutional rights. So we're really talking apples and oranges with that omnibus bill. This and that are not the same. There's no confliction. There's no conflation. There's no significant legal relationship between those bills. That's a procedural bill implementing constitutional rights. This will be a statutory right. We're not adding additional constitutional rights here. This bill has been extremely narrowly crafted to eliminate all remedies but moving the matter along. In terms of the concern that Ms. Meyer expressed, I am familiar with anecdotal evidence around the country, and it actually should be of comfort to you that it is anecdotal, that what happens when these rights are enforced, and they exist in many states around the country, is that the courts listen to the fact that there has been excessive delay, and what they will typically do is set a hearing out that is a date certain hearing. To my knowledge, there are no appellate court cases that talk about this right, and that is, I suspect, because it is working on the ground. When a trial court sees a lot of cases rolling through, they're not paying attention to any particular one. When a case is brought to their attention that has excessive delay, which this bill provides the opportunity to do, they can respond and determine how they want to react to it. Representative?
I just ask you a clarifying question.
Sure.
I don't have any criminal law background, but my question is only why we would need to do this. From what I know of judges, they hate clogged up dockets. They want to move stuff along as quickly as they can. So part of me thinks if a case is moving slowly, there may be a good reason for it. And so I'm just asking, what brought us to this point?
Well, I think what brought us to this point is that there are cases that are delayed also without good reason, Representative Garrett. We heard in the initial public hearing on this session testimony from Doug Hauser, whose case is pending the fourth sentencing hearing on the same homicide defendant in 24 years. Even if you were to divide that by four, it would be 6 years between sentencing hearings, between appeals and trials. That is inordinate delay. You also heard from a district attorney who said that the problem of inordinate delay is all too common. So there are people hurt by this. The psychologists indicate that delay creates a great deal of anxiety. I am personally aware of a woman who suffered a nervous breakdown because her trial was delayed for so many years. So this affects people, really. Justice delayed is justice denied, and it has very negative effects. The bill is written conservatively enough that courts have ample tools to continue cases for good reason, as you say. The only case I'm aware of is a district court, federal district court, trial court case, not an appellate case. And there, the federal district court said the defense needs more time to prepare for the case, so we're not going to move this along. And that's how I expect this bill would occur. What it provides is the opportunity for those citizens who are grieved by delay and are suffering from degree to be able to bring this to the attention of the court.
They
What I intend to do is we'll not move it today. I'll seek the amendment that Judge Litzcomb mentioned. I agree, and I I'm glad to hear it from him because I don't want to insult the court, the various courts, by thinking that we think they don't know that they have the constitutional ability. But if that makes people more comfortable and a clearer intent from the legislature to the judicial branch, we'll be glad to do that and get that in. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2874. And was it Representative Smith? I'll open very quickly the public hearing on 2401.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be 30 seconds. I had testimony prepared that I won't deliver, but I just wanted to give a thank you and a compliment to Representative Olson, Gail Meyer, and Brian Lashmit for approaching the issue from the same side of the table, approaching a common problem. It was really, trying to balance the interests and make sure we take care of legitimate safety concerns of officers. Really appreciated the cooperation of the stakeholders, and I now don't have to say I urge the adoption of the -3 amendments.
Okay. And thank you for your work on that bill. Hearing's closed. Meeting's adjourned.